have that reason, and we tell Allah, Ya Allah, I wasn't an expert, this is the best expert I could find, and that's acceptable. However, when we're told stories, we didn't hear it from them. We heard it from some other source. They said Ayatollah Behjat said this. They said Ayatollah Khushbakh said this. They said Sayyid Ali Qadhi Tabatabai said this. We didn't hear it from the expert. We heard it from a third party. Sometimes I've come across this myself. It has hurt me, myself. Some of those figures were alive and they were in Qum while I was there. However, although it may seem from an outsider's perspective that we have access, many times we didn't have access. Ayatollah Behjat was hard to get access to. So even as someone in Qum, what we would hear, there's a story, I'll tell you one example of this, my own personal experience, how things work in this regard. If I hear from a third party, I cannot trust it the way I would have heard it directly from him, unless that person is directly narrating from Ayatollah Behjat and they are a trustworthy source, trustworthy enough for us to pretty much say that this is what we heard from Ayatollah Behjat.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
آقایی بود به نام یوسف ابن یعقوب، ایشون مسیحی بود.
A Christian man by the name of Yusuf ibn Ya'qub was one of the politicians at the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Once Mutawakkil al-Abbasi commanded him to go to his court. He was frightened since he knew that if Mutawakkil invites someone to his court, he will be either executed or tortured. Because of this fear, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub couldn't sleep during the night. Tomorrow morning, he was preparing himself to go to Samarra.
یه همسایه‌ای داشتیم شیعه بود. رفتم پیشش گفتم شما شیعه‌ها.
When in the morning he was preparing for the trip, he went to his Shia neighbor and asked him, Can I as a Christian resort to your Imam al-Hadi to solve my problem? Does he answer me too? I'm called to Mutawakkil's court and I fear going there. The Shia neighbor of Yusuf ibn Ya'qub answered, Yes, our Imam belongs to all and his mercy befalls upon all, whether Muslims or Christians. Upon hearing this, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub became happy and said, If Mutawakkil leaves me free because of the prayer of your Imam, I will give 100 dinars in charity in the way of God. The same thing happened, and Yusuf ibn Ya'qub understood that the mercy and blessing of the Shia Imams is not limited to their Shias only. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
in the limelight.
Russian uranium ban would shift U.S. uranium production into overdrive, posing environmental and spiritual threats to indigenous communities who live near the mines. We are prepared for you an article written by Annette McGivney. The piece is titled Ready to Fight: How a Russian Uranium Ban Would Threaten Native American Tribes. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. As the United States mulls a ban on Russian uranium, part of economic levers to stop President Vladimir Putin's special operation in Ukraine, indigenous communities living near U.S. mines could pay the price. John Barrasso, a senator from Wyoming, recently introduced a bill that calls for a ban on all forms of uranium imported from Russia. Uranium fuels America's nuclear power plants, and about 20% of that comes from Russia, while close to another 30% is imported from the Russian allies, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Such a ban would shift American uranium production into overdrive. In an editorial in the Casper Star Tribune, John Barrasso pointed out that the U.S. has vast uranium resources, including in Wyoming, but 90% of the uranium used in nuclear power plants is imported into the United States. He wrote, "Rather than letting our uranium sit in the ground, we ought to use it." A longtime advocate of the uranium industry, Senator Barrasso also claimed that continuing to buy Russian uranium was funding Putin's operation. Mining companies now stand at the ready, with the possibility to ramp up production at sites near the Grand Canyon, Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, and at multiple locations in Senator Barrasso's home state of Wyoming. Many of the operations pose environmental and spiritual threats to indigenous communities who live near the mines and have fought their existence for decades. Amber Raimondo, the energy director of the not-for-profit Grand Canyon Trust, says the Senate's proposal risks perpetuating environmental injustices on our own soil. Amber Raimondo says if this ban is aimed at saving lives, the answer can't just be to ramp up U.S. uranium production. The answer has to involve truly respecting and listening to communities on the front lines of uranium production, especially indigenous communities. Otherwise, this is not about protecting human life, it is about protecting profits. When the Cold War began in the late 1940s, the federal government started a uranium boom in the U.S. by offering generous incentives to private mining companies and guaranteeing a purchase price for uranium ore. By the mid-1950s, more than 750 mines were in operation, mostly in and around Native American reservations in the Southwest, where they were rich uranium deposits. Until 1971, the U.S. government was the primary purchaser of uranium as it built up its military arsenal. Many Native Americans worked in the uranium mines, which were poorly regulated and offered few safety protections for employees or the environment. After the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, cheap uranium flooded the global market, which effectively shut down the more expensive U.S. uranium mining operations. But with imported uranium prices on the rise after Russia's special operation in Ukraine, up from $17 a pound in 2017 to nearly $60 a pound in the last few days, domestic mining companies see a unique opportunity. Denver-based Energy Fuels Resources, the second largest uranium producer in the United States, told investors in mid-March that the conflict in Ukraine could improve the company's bottom line. Mark Chalmers, the company's president and chief executive officer, in a webcast said, "With the recent events in Ukraine, security of supply in US of uranium is crucial." He added that for the first time in years, the suddenly favorable business environment had made it possible to pursue uranium sales contracts with pricing and terms that return acceptable project margins. According to Energy Fuels spokesperson Curtis Moore, the company has a total of 6 uranium mining facilities in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming that are fully permitted and licensed and could go into production pending a viable sales arrangement with a nuclear utility. Pinyon Plain Mine, formerly called Canyon Mine, has been waiting for such a moment for 35 years. Although the company has built most of the mine's infrastructure and obtained all the permits, not a pound of uranium ore has ever been extracted because uranium prices have remained so low. The mine occupies 17 acres on Kaibab National Forest, 9 miles from the south rim of Grand Canyon and 3 miles from Red Butte. The rust-colored landmark rising from the Coconino Plateau is the spiritual center for the Havasupai people, who have lived in the Grand Canyon area for more than 800 years. The 754-member tribe has been fighting the mine since it was permitted in 1986. In addition to fears about environmental and health hazards, there are also significant spiritual harms caused by the mine that tribal members say are devastating, but have been dismissed by federal courts, the mining company, and government regulatory agencies. The Havasupai elder, Carletta Tiluzi, who has been involved in fighting the mine for decades and also serves on President Joe Biden's White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, says, "We have a belief system that they don't understand. In our stories, the area where the mine is located is Mother Earth's lungs. So, when they dug the mine shaft, they punctured her lungs." In 2016, Energy Fuels completed digging a 1,400 feet deep mine shaft. The operation inadvertently pierced an aquifer that has continuously flooded the mine shaft ever since. About 40 million gallons of water with high levels of uranium and arsenic have been managed on the site, where a lined pond holds the water before it is sprayed into the air to evaporate. Environmentalists and the Havasupai people argue that the toxic water could eventually make its way into a deep aquifer that supplies the tribe's drinking water and feeds springs in Grand Canyon National Park. If the mine begins extracting uranium ore, the possibility for contamination will become exponentially greater. When asked about the controversy over Pinyon Plain Mine and its potential impact on indigenous communities, Curtis Moore attributed the assertions to environmental groups. He claimed, "There are some activists who like to spread a lot of misinformation about groundwater pollution or air pollution, but it's just not true." Amber Raimondo points out that even if Energy Fuels is currently not in violation of regulations from the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, the water coming out of the mine shaft still contains levels of uranium and arsenic that is about 30 times the amount considered safe by the Environmental Protection Agency for drinking water. And there is always the possibility that the pond holding all that water could spring a leak. Amber Raimondo says the risk of an accident is theoretical with regulators until it actually happens. The ore extracted from Pinyon Plain Mine would be trucked to Energy Fuels' White Mesa Mill, a processing facility in southeastern Utah, adjacent to the Uta Mountain community and near Burr's Ears National Monument. As the only operational uranium mill in the United States, White Mesa's processing business is likely to significantly increase with more domestic uranium production. The 40-year-old mill also produces uranium by extracting it from industrial wastes and stores leftover radioactive material on site. Like the Havasupai, the Uta Mountain Uta people are worried their drinking water could be contaminated by the mill, and they're afraid to gather traditional plants in the area or even let their children play outside when the air smells bad. In August of 2021, the tribe passed a resolution declaring that White Mesa Mill should be closed in order to protect the health of the community. But that request has not been acted upon by local government officials in Utah. Manuel Hart, the Uta Mountain Uta tribal chairman, asks, "How can we make sure tribal members can get clean drinking water when radioactive waste is just a few miles away?"
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least 8 people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realized that they are on the losing side of the war. one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen has announced a three-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters, and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Meshaat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Meshaat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdel Salam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. One that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand in recent days. Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up, but it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people, these people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world, for example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask
Why does she dress that way, all covered up? In a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day? When so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Subhanallah. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me ask you, Sheikh Javid, this question first at the beginning of this episode. You know, there are times like an emergency which happens to some individuals that they have to, in fact, break their prayer, right?
Yeah.
Well, and they can't carry on their, you know, the practice of their prayer. And there might be consequences if they don't. You're so, right. In other words, I want to rephrase my question. What are the occasions, what are those situations or scenarios which, you know, in which the obligatory prayer can be broken?
Well, it is haram, the first one, as an obligatory precaution to break obligatory prayers purposely, you know.
Yes.
To break your prayer purposely is not permissible, and without any excuses, okay? But if an excuse arises, then of course you can break your prayer. And for example, if you break your prayer in order to protect your property or to escape from financial or physical harm, for example, there's no objection to you, you can break your prayer. And it's permissible to break one's prayer for any worldly or religious purposes, which is actually crucially important for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if you see that something is being taken away by a strong wind,
mm-hmm.
and you need to protect it, or if there is, for example, wolf, you know, endangering your, you know, sheep, and the wolf is going to attack your ship, you need to protect them, okay, then of course you can break your prayer and offer the prayer later.
Yes.
This is number one. And then it is also number two, it is also permissible to break your prayer,
mm-hmm.
If you you have to either protect your life or the life of someone else whose life must be protected,
mm-hmm.
okay? It is actually obligatory for you to protect your life and to protect someone else's life. You know,
yes.
if someone is drowning and you are offering your prayers,
mm-hmm.
it becomes obligatory to break your prayer, because you have to do the thing which is more important, and the most important thing is to protect someone's life. So a drowning person is in need of help and you are offering your prayer, you know, that is not permissible. You must jump into action and quickly protect the drowning person's life. So this is number two. And the number three is, as said by the religious scholars, if a creditor
mm-hmm.
creditor demands payment from a person who is, for example, praying, and if there is a, you know, of course, if there is ample time for the prayer to be offered, he should pay him, you know, at a later time, you know, he can of course break his prayer and offer his prayer, you know, later time. But if there's no time, he should continue praying. So
right.
The creditor is waiting for him. So if there's enough time to offer the prayer, he should break his prayer, because it's very important to repay your loan and not to keep someone waiting. Probably if he is in a hurry, you have to do it quickly. But if there's no time left and you're going to lose your prayer, maybe then you have to offer your prayer first and then give the money that you owe to someone.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have number four. I suppose if a person learns during his prayer that the mosque is, for example, impure, it's najis, and of course, and if the time is short, he should complete the prayers, of
mm-hmm.
course, because
yes.
he cannot miss his prayer.
Yes.
But if there is sufficient time, and of course, making the mosque pure,
mm-hmm.
or purifying the mosque
is obligatory.
It's obligatory.
Yes.
And he should of course
break the prayer.
He should break the prayer and purify the mosque, because purifying the mosque is a collective obligation. Mm-hmm. It is an obligation for every individual.
I see.
Who comes to know that the prayer is the mosque, the masjid is najis. Okay. So if one person actually undertakes to mm-hmm. purify the mosque and wash it or make it clean,
all right,
then others are relieved of the obligation to offer, let's say. Okay. To purify the mosque.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We were talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javid, in a situation, where one must break the prayer, if he goes on, if he carries on his prayer and completes his prayer, is his prayer valid based on or in light of those situations?
You're right. Well, the prayer is valid, and of course, but the individual has sinned.
Yes.
He has committed sin for not taking action, like, for example, not saving someone's life or not protecting his property, not mm-hmm. protecting his life. Of course, right. He has committed a sin.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, his prayer is valid. And of course, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that as an obligatory precaution, he has to repeat the prayer.
Yes.
He has to repeat it. Because uh-huh. in that case, in that scenario,
right.
he was supposed to leave the prayer and to break his prayer, but he did not do so.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, can one individual break his prayer if he remembers that he did not, for example, or she did not recite Adhan and Aqama?
Well, if a person offering prayers remembers before the qira'ah, before reciting, let's say, Alhamd and Qul Huwa Allahu Ahad, Surah Ikhlas, or before going to ruku, for example, that he forgot to say the Adhan and Aqama, because Adhan and Aqama is recommended per se, And if he has sufficient time at his disposal to break his prayer and offer the prayer again,
mm-hmm.
then it is mustahab, not obligatory,
right.
Because azan and iqama are mustahab per se,
mm-hmm.
and you cannot they are not wajib. So also breaking the prayer is mustahab, and one can break his prayer and recite the adhan and iqama because to gain the sawab of reciting adhan and iqama. And that's why adhan and iqama, according to the religious scholars, are highly recommended, and one should not leave out adhan and iqama because of the high recommendation, because they are very important to be recited. And the religious authorities, generally speaking, have said that if a person misses the adhan and iqama, even before ending the namaz, even if he has crossed, for example, the qira'ah and the ruku,
the salah,
and he is about to finish the prayer,
mm-hmm.
he can still break his prayer and start his prayer afresh. He can mm-hmm. repeat the prayer because he forgot to recite the azan and qawm, and the azan and qawm are highly recommended.
I see.
So it's permissible.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice elaboration and explanation of these rules and Islamic laws related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad.